couple of works are done in collaboration with these people about magnetic properties of logarithmic superconductors. And this is the outline of my talk. In the first part, I will talk about Meissner effect and vortices in two ways. The first way would be in the effective theory description of superconductors, in which you simply assume that a superconductor is a system in which the electromagnetic U1 is spontaneously broken. And then I will consider more specifically the holographic superconductor case. This approach has the advantage to like what are the predictions of the theory and what are the generic properties of superconducting systems. In the second part, I will then consider the case of cylindrical geometries, cylindrical superconductors, which are treated by an axial magnetic field. And there are two classic effects in this kind of setup. One is the Aaron-Bohm effect, in which, this is a very well-known effect. And then the Litterpax effect, which is some sort of superconducting version of the Aaron-Bohm, in which the thermodynamical quantities in superconductors are periodic with a period which is given by one over the charge of the Cooper pair, basically. So it's not given by one over the fundamental charge, but by one over the condensed order parameter. So then I will talk about how this periodicity is broken by non-local quantum effects, and how this can happen in the limit in which the radius of the cylinder is very small. And then I will discuss about the gravity dual of this Litterpax periodicity and its breaking, because these first two parts are in the, say, effective theory approach. And then I will conclude. So let's first discuss about the motivations of holographic superconductors. As I said, most of the, most famous properties of superconductivity can be derived by assuming that U1 electromagnetism is spontaneously broken. But to understand how this spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs, you need a macroscopic theory. BCS theory is such a theory that describes just some set of conventional superconductors. But there are also others that seems to harbor some strong coupling. And some of these are the famous high-temperature superconductors. And the idea is to apply this ADS-CFT correspondence to describe these systems. So the rest of the talk, I will specifically talk about magnetic properties of these systems. And let's first introduce it with the effective theory approach. So we introduce two fields in the minimal description. One is the electromagnetic field, and the other one is a charge field that I assume to be a scalar for simplicity. And then the free energy can be written as a local functional of the field strength Fij and the covariant derivative of the field. Here I'm assuming that the superconductor is has a simply connected geometry. So I'm not adding any non-local contribution, but in the rest of the second part of the talk, I will also include such terms. We can derive some predictive effective theories from this setup. For example, for small enough fields, we expect the Ginzburg-Landau free energy, which is given here. One thing I would like to stress is the fact that to describe the Meissner effect and vortices, of course, the magnetic field has to be dynamical. And this is something challenging in holography, because usually the gauge field is an external source for the electromagnetic current. And so we will have to face this problem in the holographic part. But here I want to stress that the non-dynamical limit corresponds to the superfluid limit. While the general superconductor case, of course, include dynamics of the gauge field. So here, for example, I'm listing a set of properties that differ in the case of superfluids and superconductors. Here I'm considering the vortices, So I'm taking these ansatz for the gauge field and the condensate, where n is the one-way number. And here I'm using, of course, the polar coordinates. So for example, the field behavior of the condensate for large R, where R is the distance from the center of the vortex, has a power law in the case of superfluids, while it's an exponential for superconductors, both for the condensate and the gauge field. Then also another important property that differentiates the two cases is the vortex energy, which is logarithmically divergent for B equal to zero. And in the case of superfluids, while it's finite for superconductors, and because the dynamics of the gauge field regularize this observable. And another property is the first critical field at which the vortex becomes energetically favorable with respect to the superconducting homogeneous phase, which is which basically tends to zero when R goes to infinity in the superfluid case, while it's finite in the superconductor case. So in particular, superfluids are always of type 2, in the sense that the vortices are always favorable in a finite range of external magnetic field, while in the superconductor case can be both type 1 or type 2. And then the second critical field is one of the properties that remains the same. So the bottom line is that there are many, many things that differ in these two cases, and we have to introduce. Okay, there's a dictionary between the two cases for the different observables. In the case of the magnetic field, the external magnetic field corresponds to a rotation to the system, external rotation that you are imposing to the system. You know that superfluid is a sort of fluid that doesn't want to rotate. So you sorry?
So you're considering uncharged superfluid in a rotating frame?
You are in the rotating frame when you are considering this.
But when you're talking about magnetic field, so is it superfluid?
It's not a magnetic field in the superfluid language. So what I'm using here is just a superconductor language, electromagnetism. So and then when you make the translation, the magnetic field is not a magnetic field because of superfluid. It's an external rotation. So everything I say is probably said in the language of superconductors, not in that of superfluid. I mean, it's something else. It's, in the case of superfluid, it's an external rotation. Okay. So let's go to the holographic model. These have been introduced by these people. And the first ingredient is the background geometry, let's say, the starting point, which is an ABS geometry with a black hole. So it's given by this quantity, L is the radius of ABS, and F is defined by this formula, whereas that H is the position of the black hole. Then we have to say in more detail what the dictionary is, the ABS-CFT dictionary. So we need, first of all, a condensing operator O, just to be dual to a scalar field, psi, whose value at z equal to zero is the source of this condensing operator. And then we have to introduce the electromagnetic current, J mu. So we have to have some gauge field in the bulk whose value at z equal to zero will be the source of the electromagnetic current. This is the simplest action we can write down. Let's say we have to also to introduce the Ricci scalar, but from now on, we are neglecting the back reaction on the metric. So I'm just writing down the matter part of the Lagrangian. And this is the recipe that the ABS-CFT tells us, the way to compute the vacuum expectation value of the current and the vacuum expectation value for the condensing operator. This is a way to visualize this ABS space. We have an ABS boundary here and black hole horizon at Zh, and Zh is given in terms of the temperature by this formula. So large values of Zh correspond to small values of the temperature. This is in the, let's say, normal case in which we don't have superconductivity. Then we can turn on some, I mean, these people have proved that if we introduce a chemical potential as a z equal to zero value for the temporal component of the gauge field, we observe a phase transition at this value of the temperature, Tc, set by the chemical potential. And the profile is qualitatively given by this form, is equal to zero in the DS boundary, so the, there's no sources for the condensing operator put explicitly. So the breaking is spontaneous. And then psi z is non-zero here and goes to some non-zero value of the black hole horizon. Sorry?
That evades the no error theorems because of any of the
So the discussion about no error theorem is that I think the ADS space is something that can evade this this theorem. But what they say is that the usually assumptions hold for the flat space. In this case, we can have. I mean, given that we have an ADS asymptotic ADS space, we can have. A way to evade this no-hair theorem in this case.
Is that an energetic argument? Is it something that somehow because it's like you've got a finite distance to go before you get to infinity, that the energy cost of the field is not?
I think it's, I think it's generic. I mean, if you substitute this black hole with some thermal ADS, slice of ADS with two boundaries, one here, which is not a black hole, then you, I think you still get this non-trivial. But the nice thing here is that we know that in superconductivity, when T grows, then eventually the all the parameter goes to zero. And this makes a job, because when T grows, this goes to zero, and basically since this point has to go to zero, basically the condensate at some point. Well, if you put some sort of hard wall here, and this doesn't depend on the temperature, so you don't have this. I think this is the original motivation for putting black hole, to have a dependence on the temperature. OK, so as I was saying before, putting this as a boundary condition means that we are treating the gauge field as non-dynamical. There have been found some solutions with this boundary condition, some vortex solution. But these correspond to a superfluid setup rather than a superconductor because of this condition, the Dirichlet condition. So I have been thinking about how to promote this gauge field to a dynamical gauge field. And what we have done is to write down basically a dynamical equation for the gauge field. So remember, J mu is given by the boundary value of the bulk gauge field. We have added some external current also, and also a kinetic term for the gauge field. So what we are doing is to solve the equations of motion for the gauge field. And I will comment about this, this charge later on, about the meaning of this charge. For consistency, we also have to add this term to the action to be consistent with the variational principle. And between what, sorry? A little a mu and bigger a. This is just the boundary value. Just a boundary value. So usually this boundary value is some sort of non-dynamical source for the electromagnetic current. And here we are promoting it to a dynamical field by imposing a dynamical equation.
But are you changing the bulk action? Because one way you could interpret an equation like that would be that you had an action in the bulk, and if you vary the fields in the bulk, there's some bulk field equation, but if you vary them on the boundary, there's also normally an equation that they would have to satisfy given the bulk action to make the boundary variation stationary. So if I take the
this issue here, maybe you're saying that we have to add.
Well, if I just took the action that you're using in the bulk, and I asked under what circumstances is it stationary against variations on the boundary, would I adopt those equations, or is this a modification of the action that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we must add to ask the following term. Is this what you're saying?
This is a boundary term in the action.
Yeah. So we're imposing this, but to be consistent, we have also to add this term to the action. So we are modifying the action. That's true. I agree with that.
I would think that something like that should naturally emerge from the boundary dynamics. It should not be something that you impose by hand.
Well, there are two cases, basically, as we will see. One is the 2 plus 1 dimensional case, the case in which the CFT is 2 plus 1 dimensional. And this case, this is something that can be not by hand, because we can basically remove this term that we add by hand, as you said, because we are adding this. So in that case, we will see that the gauge field is actually emergent. It's not something you put by hand. But in the d equal to 4 case, actually, this is not possible. We see that in order to have finite results, we have to have a dynamical gauge field, we have to put by hand this counter term. I will explain this later on.
But just following that up, I mean, is that because you're really in analogous Sitter space? Because when people are doing low energy string things, for instance, and they got a long throat, you know, everything you're saying with the gauge field, you could say with the metric, right? You could say, in strictly speaking, in ABS CFT, there's no gravity in the CFT. But in these low energy string things where you've got a long throat, then there really is a low energy metric in the that you're coupling to, and it's because you're not really making, it's not really getting Sitter space. You're cutting it off with some Calabi-Yau space or something. And so, mm-hmm. So there's a mode that survives that you wouldn't see in the infinite volume limit. You wouldn't see that the mode that's a physical graviton in a string solution would become unnormalizable if you really took any Sitter space as the bulk, and so you're losing.
So you're meeting in the analogy with the graviton now, or
yeah, in a sense that I can think of ADS CFT as being, if it were really true that the gauge fields in the CFT side had to be made by hand, then the string theory, when it gives you an ADS CFT kind of a throat, should not be giving you gravity, right? But it does give you gravity in the low energy world. So there must be a mechanism already in the framework that gives you the gauge fields for the currents that are conserved in the CFT. And I thought, I don't understand it very well.
I'm not sure I understand the question. You mean how to get it from supergravity or from
supposing the I ask, everything you're asking for conserved current, I could ask for stress energy. And I could say, where is the metric? And if I were solving your framework, I'd be making a new action on the boundary to make the metric. Somewhere. Mm-hmm. But my understanding of how that works in the string case, which is not perfect, is that if you really have a string compactification which is compact, mm-hmm. so there really is a Kluczyk line zero mode, mm-hmm. then that survives in the low energy theory. That would be the graviton that the CFT would have seen. And I wouldn't have to put it in by hand in that case, I thought. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there's a similar thing for the gauge mm-hmm. field that you could do, mm-hmm. that where if you didn't really have any Sitter space, you had some.
You think you don't have the freedom to add by hand some boundary terms.
You might have the freedom, but you may not need the freedom. That's
it might arise.
Yeah, might just. But that might be the difference.
Maybe equivalent to what you're saying. But I think that if you just have the normal solution of the bound field equations, the boundary condition is some constant. But if you want to impose this other boundary condition that you want to impose,
yeah.
I mean, that just means that the solution is more complicated. So with the old solution, you could not impose this boundary condition, but maybe it's a more complicated solution, you're forced to impose that. So maybe in a sense, he's also changing the bulk solution. Just not saying it explicitly, because he's introducing this boundary action that somehow modifies the boundary condition, makes it a variable or something.
Yeah.
So I think it's self-consistent in some way, but it's not explicit maybe.
But anyway, I'm commenting in the next slide, I'm showing why this is necessary for d equal to 4. Maybe it will be clearer in the next slide. Okay. So, then the second step is to substitute this with this recipe, the SFT recipe. So what we get at the end is some sort of Neumann-type boundary condition instead of a Dirichlet-type boundary condition. Okay, so let's speak about this term, whether it can be by hand or can be removed. Say, let's first consider d equal to 4 case. But the point here is that J mu is logarithmically divergent. If you make some DS boundary expansion of this quantity, which is proportional to J mu, we get a logarithmically divergent term here, and then finite terms. So to have finite result, we have somehow to renormalize these divergences. And and then in this particular case, we can absorb, in the other case, there's no necessity to add this term. But okay, this term now is needed in this case to absorb this divergence, like we do in electrodynamics, basically. We define a renormalized electric charge, E0, in the normal phase. And in this way, the first term will be this bare coupling that I'm adding here. The second term will be this divergence, and then it will be finite terms. So we can always choose this bare coupling in a way that the final result is finite. In this case, we really need this term here, and a mu breaks conformal invariance because of this, because of renormalization, basically. And the same is true for any higher dimensions. But in the d equal to 2 plus 1 case, we have a particular situation, and we can actually remove this term because we don't have such a divergence here. And in this case, a mu does not break conformal invariance and can be considered as some sort of emerging phenomenon because basically we don't need the kinetic term for it. So we have these two different cases. In this case, we don't have any kinetic term, basically. So the kinetic term is produced by the dynamics of the system. Basically, the gauge field is some sort of composite state.
Oh, so in the infrared, you have a kinetic term, even though you did not have one in the ultraviolet. So,
in the infrared?
So you're specifying things in the ultraviolet at infinity, and you're saying that in the infrared, if I look there, I would find the kinetic term for this thing that emerges at low energies.
In a sense, yes. I mean, I'm specifying the boundary conditions in the ultraviolet, and then the let's say all the bulk gives me the kinetic term for the is produced by the CFT dynamics. Okay, so let's see how to implement this. First of all, let's consider the superfluid case. I mean, the case in which we have Dirichlet boundary condition, and we can write down a vortex ansatz in this case, which looks like this. And then we have derived the vortex configurations. Here I give the condensate and the current, in the holographic model for n equal to 1. Here we have the 2 plus 1 case. Here we have the 3 plus 1 case for some particular choices, of course, of the parameters. And the dashed lines represent the prediction of the Ginz-Bolandau theory. So as you can see, the predictions of the holographic model differ from those of the Ginz-Bolandau theory. So this is somehow interesting because, we can say that the effective theory is not the Ginz-Bolandau theory, something more complicated in this case. So let's go then to the holographic superconductor case. So we are imposing now this Neumann boundary condition. For simplicity, I'm taking the external current equal to 0, same answers as before. And here is the result. The qualitatively, we have the same profile for O, though it's a little bit different. But the important thing is that now here we can see really the exponential damping of B. B is a dynamical field, a magnetic field. And we see that for large R, we have a Meissner effect, which we cannot see for the Dirichlet boundary condition case. And in particular, we observe that A phi goes exponentially to n, as predicted by the effective field theory. And also, we have checked that the other general features of superconductors take place. And also, we have computed the critical fields HC1, HC2. And as you can see, HC1 is always smaller than HC2. So the holographic superconductors are like all the known high temperature superconductors of type 2, in the sense that there is some finite range of magnetic field for which we have vortices.
Gibbs lambda free energy from the bulk solution.
When I say Gibbs lambda theory, what I mean?
So how do you find the free energy? You find it from the bulk solution, right?
Yep. What's the question? If the question concerns the comparison between Gibbs lambda, then well, we have fitted the theory by using somehow determine the two parameters of the theory in this way. We have two parameters in Gibbs lambda. One is the inverse mass, basically. And the other one is the quartic self-coupling. And then, of course, there is also the charge. The first one can be extracted by computing the second critical field. And these two can be computed by looking at the large R behavior of the different quantities. So we have determined these three input parameters. We have computed the vortex in the Gibbs lambda case and the holographic superconductor case, and we have seen that they are different.
So please correct me if I'm wrong. I somehow thought that you should be able to find these parameters without looking at the vortex. You just look at what happens near the phase transition, right? And basically, look at the static free energy and then match the parameters.
Well, you also need the electric charge. So, if you look just at the phase transition, you mean phase transition with the magnetic field also, or?
Well, you can find the parameters without any electromagnetism and then just gauge.
But then you also need this. There are also other ways to get these parameters. I'm just telling you the way we used.
But will you get the same answer? That's...
For these two, yes, I think so. BGL and XIGL should get the same answer. So what you have to do is to, for example, you can compute this, the mass of the Gibbs-Landau theory close to criticality. Mm-hmm. And then by using the value of the condensate you observe, you can compute also the quartic subcoupling mass, and then the value gives you the quartic subcoupling. This should be the same, yeah. I'm just telling you the way we use. Because for us was as simple as that, because we already had the vortex solution. So. Yeah, if you don't have the water solution, it's much, much simpler to do it, as you said, of course.
Is it possible to get a type 1 holographic superconductor?
We tried, but we varied the parameters, but we never found type 1. I consider this an interesting property, that it's always type 2. Well, maybe by modifying the bulk theory a lot, you can get type 1. But in this model, you always get type 2.
The start would be if you could make
the statement is numerical, but
yeah. Yeah. If you could make it supersymmetric, that would be a start, because that's kind of like right on the boundary between type 1 and type 2.
If you make it supersymmetric?
Yeah. I don't know if it's possible.
I see. Okay. I see the question. You're asking if you can have a BPS solution.
Yeah.
By modifying the bulk theory.
But I don't know if it's possible.
If you don't modify the bulk theory, I don't think so, because the BPS solution means that it's not type 2, it's on the border, and we always find type 2. But if you modify the bulk, so the bulk theory, I'm not sure. Maybe yes. Not sure. But anyway, even in Gibbs-Landau, the BPS case, you never find an analytical solution. So
not sure.
we haven't tried so much because we didn't see any reason to do it, because even in Gizmo Lambda we don't find an analytical solution in the DPS case. So for me, there was no motivation. But maybe
it's often true that if you're going to get an analytic solution, you'll find it for the DPS case, even if you don't get it for the general case, because it's a first order set of equations, so you have a better chance.
Yeah, but still, you know.
it's
easier, but for the vortices, as far as I know, nobody has found the solution, even in the PPS case, unlimitedly. Okay, a bit late. So let's go to the second part of the talk. The setup now will be a bit different. I'm considering some multiply connector space, in particular some cylindrical geometry, and I'm threading the superconductor with an axial magnetic field. As I say, there are these two effects, I'm not repeating. And if I remember, I said that little pax is the periodicity of the thermodynamical quantities with respect to the flux of B, with a period which is set by the inverse charge of the condensate. And this is expected to occur, I mean, should occur eventually for a large enough radius. But if we consider a small radius, compared to the coherence length, basically at zero temperature, I will explain it more later on, then we expect some non-local quantum effects to take place in this case, because we are considering very, very small radius. And I'm going to describe this in the effective theory approach, and we will see that this is possible. And then I will move to holography and state that this transition between the periodicity, which is set by one over the charge of the condensate, and the non-local quantum effects case, in which, as we will see, this periodicity is completely broken, corresponds to the Hawking-Page phase transition in holography. That we'll explain it. And here I'm giving some motivations for this study. One is that there is actually some both theoretical and experimental activity in condensed matter for this setup. And then the fact that holography basically provides you this, not by hand, but automatically this transition between LP periodicity and its breaking, as I will explain later, I hope. If it's not clear, please interrupt me, because LP is, because I explained it before, but now I repeat it. I'm going to explain it now. So, what it is this. Okay. This is our own bomb, so I'm not repeating, maybe it's too well known. It's just a quantum effect which occurs in multiply connected spaces. It's the dependence of the spectrum on the magnetic flux in a periodic way, with a period given by 1 over E, the charge of the fundamental charge carriers, basically. And here is a way to derive it, but it's quite standard. So this is the Aronson bomb. The important thing is the fact that it's a quantum effect in multiply connected spaces, and that we have this period set by the fundamental charge. The little pax can be maybe some sort of superconducting version of this effect. I'm taking now the effective field theory approach as before, and I'm modifying the action by adding some non-local terms. These dots represent non-local terms. And let's consider the Gibbs-Landau for simplicity, even though all I'm going to say is valid for a genetic theory. So what is little pax? So a crucial fact to understand the little pax is the residual discrete gauge symmetry we have in superconductors. In real superconductors, we have Z2, but here I'm considering a more general case. And for non-trivial topologies, we have to introduce non-local gauge invariant quantities, like the Wilson line I've defined before. This quantity, or the so-called fluxoid, where theta is the phase of the condensate. So since the condensate has n times the charge of the fundamental carriers, there are, in principle, n distinct fluxoid configurations given by these ansatz. And the Litterbach's effect state that these configurations are degenerate. This is the Litterbach's effect. So let's understand it in the Ginzburg-Landau. Let's put AT equal to a chemical potential. And let's insert these ansatz in the action. Then we get an effective inverse mass, psi effective, given by this formula. The first one is the let's say the parameter we have in the Lagrangian, and then we have these quantities. The first one comes from the interaction between the gauge field and the condensate, and the second one comes from also the covariant derivative. So basically, here I'm giving a typical phase diagram for this setup. Here I'm varying the gauge field, and here I'm varying the chemical potential, and we see that we have a perfect periodicity. There is this the general situation between the different fluxoid sectors. So to understand a little bit better why this occurs, I think one has to basically look at the covariant derivative for the scalar field, and whatever the action is, even if it's not Ginzburg-Landau, as long as the theory is local, we will always have A and M appearing in this combination in the action. So the key to the Litterbach's is the locality. Whenever we have a local action, we can always compensate the discrete shift in the fluxoid with a discrete shift in the external Wilson line, in the external gauge field. And so we will always have this degeneracy. But in principle, when the radius is very small, the parameters can acquire non-local dependence on the non-local quantities. For example, here I'm giving two possible sources of this non-local dependence. One is the Aronbaum-Casimir effect, in which the vacuum energy for multiply kinetic spaces acquire dependence on the Wilson line. And another possible source is the effective operator J mu d mu theta, where J mu is the electric current, which can lead to an M dependence. But here I'm giving you some plots for to understand how this can happen. In plot A, we have XiGL and BGL independent on M and W as before. And the other two, we are introducing a dependence on this local, no local quantities.
It's like, how do you think about, you know, magnetic field and chemical potential?
Yeah, but I can write it in terms. So it's not completely. I mean, there's a range of a chi which cannot be removed by gauge transformation for multiply kinetic spaces.
Maybe could you say, like in simple words, like what is the physical meaning of these pictures here?
So here, okay, maybe it would have been better to put the Wilson line. So imagine here I put the Wilson line the same for the configuration. The Wilson line I defined here. So I'm probing the system with a magnetic field. That means I have some Wilson line different from zero given by this formula, putting some magnetic field. And then I'm looking at the transition.
So your AX is on the compact direction.
Then the Wilson line is given by some gauge field along the compact direction.
So X is the compact direction.
Chi. Yeah. I call it chi.
Or is it chi?
This symbol here. Yeah, yes. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, it's okay. And I'm probing the system. Then I see a perfect periodicity of the phase diagram with some line versus chemical potential in the Litterbach's case. So the, for example, so this blue line represents the blue line. Sorry, the blue lines represent the transition between the superconducting and normal phase, and these dashed green lines represent the different M channels. So the transition is perfectly periodic with respect to shift of the Wilson line. I'm changing the magnetic field, then I after this is the physical one. Okay, so let's go to a holography and see how we can get this phenomenon. Here we are compactifying a special dimension, and so we have two possible phases with this set of symmetry. One is the black hole phase, given by the same formula I gave it before. So we have a black hole horizon, and this is given in terms of the temperature, and this phase is favorable for large enough radius in terms of the temperature. The other phase, which is favorable in another case, is the soliton phase, which is obtained by definition by a double weak rotation of time and compact dimension. And now this f of z is given by this formula, where z0 is set by the radius. And the transition between the two, of course, either if you vary the temperature, as I said before, or if you vary the chemical potential. And of course, for these values of chemical potential and temperature, and it is known as a Hawking-Page transition. And we will see that this Hawking-Page transition corresponds exactly to the transition between the Litter-Pak's behavior and its breaking due to local quantum effects. Okay, so let's consider the two cases to understand why this occurs. This is the first case, the black hole phase. We impose boundary conditions as before. Aki now is the boundary value of capital Aki, introducing a chemical potential. And the crucial point to understand why the black hole phase corresponds to the Litter-Pak is that the infrared boundary condition is actually local, in the sense that the gauge field and the fluxoid appears in the local combination. And so the result is perfectly a Litter-Pak periodic result. Here the line code is as before, and I'm using these values for the parameters. Now, if you go to the soliton case, the crucial point is that the infrared boundary conditions are not local. So for example, AKI has to be zero at the tip of the cigar, which you have in the soliton case. And we have also no local boundary conditions for the scalar field. And so the result is not at all periodic with the Litter-Pak period, as you can see in the plot. So, I mean the crucial point is the boundary condition on the infrared point. It's the source for the non-locality in this case. Here, I don't know if I have, how much time do I have?
We started just a little bit after 1, right? So you have about 50 minutes.
Okay, so the last property I wanted to talk about is about this Noether theorems. As we were saying before, the presence of this scalar hair is a way to evade these Noether theorems. But here we have another one. The black hole is carrying some quantum hair also in this case. Because, if you split the gauge field in this way, where m prime is some integer and a tilde chi is the rest, we observe that the black hole is only affected by the difference between m prime m and a tilde chi. But at the quantum level, some dependence should show up. So basically, this combination of the two integers, m prime plus m, represents a quantum hair for the black hole. While in the soliton case, we have an explicit dependence on m and a chi separately. So basically, for the black hole, in the limit of infinite number of degrees of freedom, where we have a classical approximation, the gravity side, the black hole, the confined phase admits a classical limit, in the sense that the quantum effects like Aaron-Bohm effect are suppressed, while in the soliton case, we have explicitly some quantum effects because we observe the breaking of the little pax degeneracy. Okay, so here I'm giving the conclusions. This is a summary of what we have done in the first part about mass and effect and vortices. And here is an outlook for what we have done. The first one is something we are actually working on now and we are going to publish soon, is the vortices in ADS soliton case. This is interesting because for ADS soliton, we have the transition between the normal and superconducting phase is actually a transition between an insulator and a superconductor, which is something which is actually observed in some high temperature superconductors. And another possible outlook I'm interested in is the implementation of this way to obtain a dynamical gauge fields in holographic QCD. For example, to probe QCD holographically with some electromagnetic field and taking into account the dynamics of this electromagnetic field. And here is a summary of the second part. And here is some outlook for the second part. One is the something we're going to publish soon is basically the combination of vortices plus Wilson line, which we have observed to be another way to find a breaking of this little pax degeneracy due to non-local quantum effects. And then if some experiments will give you some deviation from the little pax behavior as expected in the condensed matter community, it would be interesting to compare this with the experiments. Okay. That's it. Okay.
Questions. Can I ask you to clarify something? Like you've been doing classical electromagnetism and ADS basically here, and then at some point you started to talk about quantum effects. So where was this jump? Where did this
come? What I wanted to do is in first part I was just dealing with simply connected spaces like surfaces probing by a magnetic field. So the first part is the setup. Two ways of, can I erase? The first part, I'm basically probing a system like this with some external magnetic field in this way. And in the second part, I'm considering also some multiply connected space like cylinders threaded by an external magnetic field. So in this case, the magnetic field hits the superconductor of this form. In this case, it is an axial magnetic field. And in the second part, the non-local effects are not relevant because the space is simply connected. And in the second part, we have to take into account this non-local quantities in the action. So the point at which I switch to non-local quantum effects.
But I don't understand. The very fact that you simply choose to look at Wilson loops doesn't mean that you are studying quantum physics in them.
I think the point is that the breaking of this little pax effect occurs basically because of Aaron-Bohm effects, which is a quantum effect. But this is the only way I can think about it. So quantum effect, the Aaron-Bohm effect is sensible to 1 over, Aaron-Bohm effect is sensible to, it corresponds to a periodicity given by 1 over E, where E is the electric charge. And this is definitely a quantum effect. And in the little pax case, we have a periodicity given by 1 over G, which is for real superconductors equal to 2E. Okay, basically, there's some pi factor here. It's not well. So the transition between Litter packs with pi over E period and Aleron bomb and the breaking of these Litter packs, I think it has to be interpreted as a signal of quantum effects, because it has to occur because of Aleron bomb. So something like this.
But the quantum, you mean quantum on the boundary?
Sorry?
So quantum effect, you mean quantum effect on the boundary? Boundary CFT.
No. It's in the full CFT. Oh, because you have the language of boundary. Okay. I mean, when you say boundary, you mean the CFT.
Yeah. CFT.
It's a quantum effect in the boundary. The in the boundary, yes. Not in the bound.
But then what do you mean by classical effect? Because the moment you talk about ADS CFT, it's on the ADS side, it's semi-classical, but already the CFT side, it's always quantum, right? What do you mean by classical and quantum? This difference, I don't understand.
I'm not sure I understood,
because
I don't hear very well.
I understand when you say quantum, what you're meaning is quantum in the sense that if you wanted to make a quantization argument, you need the existence of a charge whose phase and the wave function you're trying to make it vary, but you're not really using any of the.
I'm saying, because I mean, I'm distinguishing between basically Ginz-Bolandau and its extensions, which are basically treated as a classical theory, and quantum effects on top of it, which are given, for example, by Aaron Baum effects this time.
But the transition, if I understand you right, so you've got a circle direction in space, because it's finite temperature, you've got a circle direction in time. And then the trade-off between these solutions is that you integrate in from infinity for z, and then one of them pinches off, and the question is who pinches off first? And mm-hmm. that decides whose free energy is the lowest. And the non-locality, is it because the Wilson line, so if in a situation where the spatial direction pinches off first, that means it's small enough that the energy cost of wrapping a Wilson line around that is not expensive? Or what physically, why is it that that's...
Why do you have non-locality? That's because... in the non-locality occurs in the soliton phase,
yeah.
And the reason is this: the presence of the so you know that the soliton we have this kind of geometry. This is the geometry of the soliton. So we have a tip here. And for consistency, we have to say that the value of the gauge field along the compact direction has to be 0 at this tip, right? The condition for regularity. But this, crucially, is not a local condition in the sense that it does not involve a chi and m in the local combination, where the local combination is this one that we have in the black hole phase. So whenever we don't have this, but we have something else, that means we have something non-local. That's for sure. Because you have to see this as a condition on the Wilson line, which is a non-local operator. Otherwise, it would be not gauge invariant. The only way to see that this is gauge invariant is to see it as a non-local condition.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you one more time.